Now, for something completely different, here is your host, Brian Wilson.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and people of all sexes, especially those of you who regret skipping those economics classes, it's time once again for something completely different. Brian Wilson's my name. Of course, you know who you are, and for the next 30 minutes, I'm finally going to be able to chat with the president. Yes, it's not often one gets such a privilege, made even more special by the fact that it is not President Biden. When I met Tom DiLorenzo some 30 years ago, he was a celebrated economics professor at Loyola University in Baltimore. His first big media splash came back when, right about that time, he was being interviewed on a Baltimore TV station, and he made this profound statement: "I'm better at grilling than Brian Wilson is at making chili." That's a direct quote. Now, despite the contentious but successful lawsuit for slander that followed, we managed to remain friends over the years. Then in 2003, while I was submitting articles of debatable worth to lourockwell.com, Tom was busying himself writing important books, books on public health, the American Revolution, organized crime, capitalism, socialism. And then there's my personal favorite, The Real Lincoln. We'll get more on that later. But tempest fugit, as it always does, and the next thing I know, my friend Tom has been appointed president of the vaunted Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama, a stroke of genius by the administration and a ginormous boon to such a prestigious outfit. Always a pleasure to chat with the now president, Thomas James DiLorenzo. Hello, Mr. President. May I still call you Tom?
Yes, for now, until I decide what title I'd like you to address me as.
Well, gee, the president, his honor, his excellency. Well, I'm sure you'll find one that fits the
bill.
Any
of those will work.
Any of them. Listen, we got about 30 minutes, as I mentioned. I thought, especially for those people who have not gotten themselves acquainted with the Mises Institute, as I have, as president, I wonder if you could just give us a thumbnail of what the Mises Institute is, the mission statement, what it does, like that.
Okay, the Mises Institute is an economic education institute. It's been around for 42 years, founded by Lou Rockwell and Murray Rothbard. With the assistance of Ron Paul, who's been a senior advisor all during that time. He also had assistance at the very beginning by Henry Hazlitt and a few other well-known free market people. And the focus of what we do is educating the general public, anybody and everybody. We're not a think tank like the Cato Institute or any of those. We don't focus on influencing congressional staffers or anybody like that. And it's economic education from the perspective of the Austrian school, the free market Austrian School of Economics. And also, since Murray Rothbard was one of the founders, Rothbardian libertarian political economy, that's a mouthful, is also a focus of studying the state. And so we have a summer school called Mises University that's been around for over 30 years. We always have over 100 students from all over the world every summer. We publish books, we hold conferences. In fact, tomorrow we're commencing a conference on the 75th anniversary of the book Human Action by Ludwig von Mises, which I think is the greatest economics book ever written in ever, period. And so we do that. We have podcasts, we have the Radio Rothbard once a week. And we try to educate as many people as we can about how markets work and how governments don't work.
What is the Mises Wire?
Well, we have on our website, Mises.org, which I consider to be the very best website in the world on the issue of political economy. We have several different segments of that. The Mises Wire has daily articles on current events, current issues, primarily. We have something called Power and Market that is a different part of the website. And so the Mises Wire is just sort of a current articles about current issues related to economics and government in general.
And all of this available at Mises.com without .org rather without any. There's no paywalls. There's no hocus pocus. You can
no,
tap
nothing
into
at all.
Any of these columns, right?
No, nothing like that. And in our website, we have hundreds of free books online that you can get. You can get a great education. When I was still a professor, you know, I was a professor for 41 years, an economics professor, I would tell my students, you could probably get just as good an education by just reading Mises.org articles every day. And so it's not just the articles. We have a huge archive on the website of books and publications of all sorts, videos, podcasts, and you can get a very good education by just browsing the website every day and reading some of the articles.
You know, Thomas Carlyle, and I think our good friend Walter Williams both said economics is the dismal science. So that's why I slept through Eco 101 when I was in school. But I get the dismal part. Someone else said it was the boring science. But why does it get slammed like that?
Well, the main so-called mainstream deserves that title. It is boring. Whenever I meet somebody, like on the golf course or something, someplace, and ask me what I do for a living, and I tell them, they would say, "Oh, I took economics in a class in college, and I hated it." And it's because of the way it's taught. The attraction to me of the Austrian School of Economics has always been that, one, it's mostly literary. It's not a big configuration of mathematical symbols, which is what mainstream economics has turned into. And two, the Austrians, it's called the Austrian School because some of the founders were from Austria, like Ludwig von Mises. Even though he taught at New York University for several decades, he was from Austria. They're all about using economics to understand how the world works, not understanding how mathematical models work. And that's what's taught in the mainstream economic programs in universities, this obsession with mathematical models. But the Austrians were obsessed with understanding reality. And they also had the attitude that economics is not just about understanding financial markets or how to make money. It's about life. It's about human action. The title of the book, Human Action. If you have a good understanding of basic economics, you can have a good understanding of human life in general. I used to tell my students, at least the boys in the class who are interested in this mostly, is that there was an interview with Bill Belichick, the former coach of the New England Patriots, who was an economics major in school. And he said in his interview that he used basic economics that he learned in college to make every single decision he ever makes as a football coach. And I wanted to impress upon the students, and a lot of them are sports enthusiasts, that economics is about understanding human life. It's not just about understanding business and industry and financial markets. And that's what we try to do at the Mises Institute. And it's interdisciplinary as well. At our conferences, we have economists, historians, philosophers, political philosophers, and that's been the method of the Austrian school. Not as narrow as the mainstream.
I noticed you got a great shout out from, see if I can pronounce his name correctly, Renato Moicano.
Yes, the UFC fighter.
Yes.
Renato Moicano. He just finished a surprise victory in Las Vegas, and Joe Rogan was interviewing him, and he grabs the mic from Joe Rogan and says, If you care about your country, read Ludwig von Mises. Of all the things to say, his face was all swollen and bloody from the fight. And that equated quite a storm of publicity for us. And I immediately invited him to come to our Mises University summer school in July here in Auburn. He lives in Florida. And I haven't heard back from him yet, but I'm going to write him again. And we just had a T-shirt made up with his picture on it saying that, if you care about your country, read Ludwig von Mises. And he had some bad language in there, and we left the bad language out.
Well.
And, there. But yeah, that created quite a stir. And so as a result, you know, we have all these free books, including Human Action by Ludwig von Mises, that are downloads on our website. And we had tens of thousands a day of downloads of these books by Ludwig von Mises in response to what he had to say.
That's great. I want to go back for a second. I don't want to get too far into the weeds, but it's something I never clarified either in any of our conversations or with Walter or with Tom and the rest of the folks that I've managed to bump into. You've talked about the Austrian School of Economics. My understanding, there's also a Chicago School of Economics. I'm trying to understand, what is the significant difference between the two schools? Is it a disciplinary thing? Is it subject matter? Is it focus? Where does it come in?
Well, one of the main differences is the Austrian school focuses on economic logic, whereas the Chicago school claims that in order to have a valid economic theory, you have to have some kind of statistical test that verifies it. And a lot of what goes on in mainstream economics from that perspective is using elaborate statistics to prove that water runs downhill, or that the sun rises in the east and sets in the west. And a lot of it comes to be very trivial. For example, the Austrians will say, if the government raises the minimum wage to, say, $30 an hour, common sense and logic will tell you, and the laws of supply and demand will tell you, that it will create higher unemployment among lower skilled people, like teenagers who are looking for jobs. And you don't need an elaborate system of statistical tests to understand that. The Chicago school will claim, well, yes, you do. And so what happens in a lot of the economics debates is that clever mathematicians and clever statisticians will spend their careers inventing what they think are clever statistical tests that disprove these common sense things. For example, about 15 years ago, there was a publication of an article that claimed to find that when the New Jersey raised the minimum wage law, it created higher employment, not lower employment. And then it turned out that the data was all wrong, that when they gathered the data on employment, they called businesses up in New Jersey on the phone, and they didn't distinguish between a part-time worker who was working, say, 10 hours a week, and a full-time worker who was working 40 hours a week. They considered everybody a 40-hour a week worker. And so the whole study was confounded, and it became irrelevant, although it took several years for people to find this out. And so this study was given all sorts of awards, and one of the authors of it actually won the Nobel Prize in Economics. And that's the kind of nonsense that can go on if you follow only the Chicago School method. The Austrians rely more on the logic of economic theory and common sense, and we're not averse to history and statistics, but we don't rely on that as the sole determinant of economic reality.
I'm getting the sense then, a very strong impression, that the dismal and boring part came from Chicago.
That's a part of it. That's a part of it. I think the actual statement about Thomas Carlyle, the dismal science, mm-hmm. was I think Carlyle himself was a defender of slavery, and so it was somehow associated with economics, you know, the economic scholar, but it really has no, I don't think it has. That phrase has anything to do with the Chicago school per se.
Well, I get the sense, I get the point on the Chicago school, and it would also seem logical to me, based on that New Jersey study, that it must have gotten a hell of a write up in the New York Times. I think there's a guy over there that's pretty famous at coming up with some pretty remarkable theories and forecasts, as far as
yes, it did, and of course the logic says, well, why so stingy? If a $30 an hour minimum wage is a good idea, why not $300 an hour?
Yeah, really.
And they make everybody rich, $1,000 an hour. That's sort of the logic of it. But for a while there were a lot of people were fooled by this study.
Well, I think people in California are probably getting that message loud and clear right now with that situation.
They just have a super minimum wage there. And so, and I'm sure what you've been reading, Brian, is that the fast food restaurants are really speeding up the automation, where you go to the restaurant and you don't have to talk to a human being anymore. You can just order your food on a machine, and the machine will give you your food, and they're not hiring human beings. Our friend Walter Williams, in his many articles that he wrote about the minimum wage, pointed out decades ago the phenomenon of how the gas stations in America used to have people who'd come out and pump your gas. And if you went to the theater, they would have a young person that would, with a flashlight, who would walk you to your chair. But the minimum wage priced those kinds of jobs out of the market many decades ago. And so we're seeing sort of a modern digital age version of this now in California and elsewhere, where those jobs are not going to exist anymore.
Yeah, I kind of thought it was almost diabolical with Silicon Valley right up the road that all of a sudden it would be California that would bring this thing in through the back door, which, like you say, is going to eliminate an awful lot of jobs for high school kids and part-time college students and so on. But it's going to do really well for the people that are into automation and programming those things to get you double mac, double cheese with fries and whatever.
Oh yeah, they'll be selling all these gadgets and machines. In the older days, the unions were in favor of raising the minimum wage because a lot of low-skilled workers competed with union workers. For example, if you had a house painter who made $10 an hour back in the day, and is a professional and a union member, and he's pretty productive, he has experience. But you could also hire a couple of college kids at $5 an hour each who could do the same job in the same amount of time.
Right.
And since they're young and they're in school, they're not as productive as the older guy, but two of them can do the job. And so you could have two at $5 an hour or one at $10 an hour. And if you raise the minimum wage to, say, $8 an hour, now it costs you 16 bucks an hour for the college kids, and they're not going to be hired. So the unions understood this, and they were all, and no union member ever worked for minimum wage. And so they understood that they could price the competition out of the market. And our friend Walter Williams also has written, some very extensive research on the minimum wage in his writings, his book Race and Economics. And at the beginnings of the minimum wage in the 30s, what was happening is a lot of the black sharecroppers from the South were losing their jobs in the farming. And so they went to the cities looking for work. And since they were relatively unskilled at manufacturing work, they were offering the work for lower pay. And Walter quoted some of the politicians of the day, the 1930s, as coming right out and saying, well, we have all these black workers competing for our union jobs, and we need to do something about this. And so the minimum wage was what they decided they wanted to do something about to price them out of the business. And so, especially the northern manufacturing companies, the steel mills and so forth, they were beginning to compete with steel mills in Birmingham, Alabama, and places like that. And they favored the minimum wage because they wanted to price out of the market competition from these southern steel mills, where the South was finally recovering from the Civil War economically. And so it was all about sort of economic warfare. It wasn't about compassion for the poor people.
So we can see that economics does have a compelling side to it rather than just charts and graphs and numbers and so on. Moving on from that to where we are today, looking at America's situation, maybe a little late in the game, but how do you start going back to your comments when you're at Loyola about reading books on the Mises Institute's website? How do you, if you're starting from ground zero and you want to build a healthy understanding of basic economics, I got to believe there's got to be some really great books out there. You mentioned Rothbard, Hayek, Hazlitt, Friedman, Tom Sowell, Walter Williams, some Guy DiLorenzo, and so on. What would you pick out with, say, like three books for someone who can, whose basic talent doesn't go beyond being able to spell economics, but he's looking at
Well,
our national debt and inflation and all, he wants to get a handle on that. What would you suggest?
Well, last year, the Mises Institute gave away 100,000 copies of Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt. We had some very generous donors who gave us enough money to do that, and we gave away all 100,000 copies just last week. So that would be one book, Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt. Second book is we just started last week giving away 100,000 copies of What Has Government Done to Our Money by Murray Rothbard. So you can contact the Mises Institute today, anyone who's listening. Go to Mises.org and we will send you a free copy of What Has Government Done to Our Money. And the third book I would recommend would be The Law by Friedrich Bastiat. And we have a Mises Institute published version of it and it's online. And so I would read The Law by Bastiat. And the fourth book would be How Capitalism Saved America by me, or also by me, The Problem of Socialism.
Writing all this down. We'll put links at the on the website for all of these books at the Mises organization. And one thing about The Law by Bastiat, the really nice part about that, it's short. It's
Yes.
short. But it takes you a long time to read it because every sentence, every paragraph is like getting cold water in the face. It's easy to understand, but it contradicts so many things that you may have been raised with believing that it may take a moment.
Still a popular book, and it was published in 1850.
Yeah, and even some of the pundits and commentators on TV are talking about the broken window. They're actually pulling bits and pieces out of there that if you haven't read the book, you might not get the import of what it is.
Yes.
And I would go on to say just because I got it a couple of years ago when it came out, the Politically Incorrect Guide to Economics. I'm not recommending it just because you wrote it. Yeah, I recommend there's several books here that you wrote that I would stand behind 100%. But for a good running start into the deeper waters of economics, you couldn't go wrong with the Politically Incorrect Guide to Economics. Speaking of books, I'd be remiss to not mention my personal favorite, The Real Lincoln, published in 2002 with a foreword written by our friend Walter. This doesn't really have a whole lot to do with economics in the vein that we're talking about it right now. It's not void of the subject in there, but the big part, the big memory, and I don't know that I ever told you all this, Tom, but you were a guest on my show on KSFO San Francisco not long after the book came out. And within about 10 minutes, the entire station phone system went down due to the volume of incoming calls from listeners who were not thrilled to death with the things you were saying about Honest Abe.
Yes.
And despite all the accolades that came from all the appropriate quarters, there's certainly a lot of there was a lot of book critics who just went ballistic with this. Was this just cognizant dissonance, or did they have a philosophical problem with the way Abe was portrayed in grade school and the way you were portraying him in The Real Lincoln?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of what I found is a lot of people get very angry when you point out that they've been fooled and bamboozled their entire lives about something. And that's one case. And then there's the professional academic historians. And at about the same time, Brian, that you interviewed me, I had an email from Paul Craig Roberts. And he said, "You've destroyed their human capital. That's why they're attacking you." In other words, I pointed out all these facts about Lincoln that were unflattering, such as in his first inaugural address, he supported a constitutional amendment that would have prohibited the government from ever interfering in slavery. And who's taught that in public school? And it's a plain fact. It was called the Corwin Amendment to the Constitution, and it had been passed by the House and Senate. And so, and these are facts that if they're pointed out at all by these academic historians, they're followed by 10 or 20 pages of excuses and rationales of why Lincoln had to do this. And I just lay it out and say, well, this is what he did, and it's contrary to the image that you get. And so it was an attack on the reputation of the history profession. So I had a lot of smears and libels and slanders from them. And then I think the other group of people is that people just resent being someone being put in their face that you've been bamboozled your whole life, and haven't you been a fool by believing these things? And so, and then you've got the super patriots who then the people who keep chanting USA, USA on television every once in a while, who don't want to hear, don't want, just don't want to, they're like, the monkeys with the hear no evil, see no evil about America. They've been brainwashed in the American exceptionalism. We're the most exceptional and moral people on earth. Therefore, we can drop bombs on whoever we want to drop bombs on. It's that crowd, and they hated it. And of course, the neoconservatives hated it because they're state worshipers, and they have Lincoln and Churchill as their two main icons. And so, and I was criticizing their icon, and they didn't like that either.
Yeah, I thought it was, spot on as far as I was concerned. I spent half my life living in the South, and you get an entirely different perspective than the prep school that I went to in Connecticut and so on. But just
Yeah, well, even if you look at Amazon, I think it was something, still to this day, it's something like 85% of the reviews are 5-star. So, but it was kind of funny at the beginning, the reviews were all either throw away the family Bible and put DiLorenzo's book in its place, or hang the author immediately. Nothing
Well,
in between.
that the Wikipedia page that I looked up a couple of weeks ago, I was just amazed at what, smear after smear, and it's, of course, they're begging for commentary and adjustment and citations and all the rest, but it's still hanging up there. But I'm just looking at
That's
my
mostly
copy of The
written.
Real Lincoln, and it said, you autographed it for me. You said, Brian Wilson, who never rules out sheer stupidity when things go wrong. That's absolutely true. There, that's that. The other thing, too, as long as we're talking about books for a second, I also have my copy of The Politically Incorrect Guide to Economics here, and there was a part at the end, right at the end, where you said, "My purpose in writing this book has been to stimulate interest in doing just that, meaning to help you become your own economist, to continue learning long after you put this book down, and to pass on the habits to family, friends, and fellow citizens in general." And I find it interesting that that after writing that several years ago, you're now in a position as president of the Mises Institute to actually make that happen in a broader way than just the publication of a book.
Yes, it's very exciting. It's one of the reasons I took the job. I retired from my university job in 2020, and I played a lot of golf for about a year and a half. And then this opportunity came up, and I'm excited about it. We have a lot of good things planned. We're planning in the next year or two a couple of conferences and books on a revisionist history of war, among other things. And so that's one thing we're going to do. Because war is the health of the state, and one of my favorite chapters in the book Human Action is on the economics of war, and so and of course being able to give away 100,000 copies of What Has Government Done to Our Money is an exciting thing for me to be doing at this point,
No
and we
doubt.
hope to be doing more of things like that.
Well, I want to put down your list of must-read books, and I'll also get a reminder in there about what the government has done to our money. I'm thrilled today. You're only right up the road here. You're only about an hour away in Auburn, and I look forward to coming by and having you buy me several drinks and lunches and things
Oh,
along that
sure.
line.
Anytime you must do that. Come down anytime, and I'll take you out on the expense account.
Yeah, that'll be great. Oh, before I go, first of all, please pass along my best to Lou. I hope he's feeling well and doing well. And
I will.
Karen DeCosta Campbell, another new addition to the Mises Hall of Fame,
Yes,
asked
she's here
me.
now.
Yes, she asked me to ask you to endorse the petition that's currently circulating around campus, officially declaring her puppy Rothbard as the official Mises mascot, with all appropriate honorariums and food and things like that. So I
Oh,
just.
yeah, she had Rothbard here on her last trip, and I was in my office working, and I heard out in the hall what sounded like a Joe Biden speech, and I was saying, "Who the heck is playing a Joe Biden speech?" I opened my office door, and here was Rothbard running around barking his head off.
Well, why not?
Yeah.
It's a great place, and I'd be pretty excited there too. The couple of times I've visited. Tom, thanks a lot for the time. Always a pleasure yapping with you, and I look forward to great things coming out of the Mises Institute with you up there at the helm.
Okay, looking forward to your visit, Brian.
I'll be there.